Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
When Journey, Def Leppard, and Cheap Trick played Busch Stadium in the summer of 2018, I had the chance to chat with legendary guitarist and the founder of Journey, Neil Sean. Keep in mind, this is a guy who was just 15 years old when he started playing with Carlos Santana. Eric Clapton tried to recruit him for Derek and the Dominoes. A recent inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Today on Profiles, Neil Sean.
Welcome to Profiles. From entertainers to athletes, political leaders to entrepreneurs, Profiles gives you an insight into what has made these unique personalities who and what they are today. Now, Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
A big show this weekend, Journey, Def Leppard, Cheap Trick, and this is Neil Sean doing a tribute to Aretha Franklin the other night. He'll be there, obviously, leading the way with Journey. They'll be the headliners on Friday night at Busch Stadium. Neil, how are you? Welcome to KMOX.
I'm doing good, Mark. How are you, buddy?
Fantastic. We are really excited here in St. Louis about this show. I'm really pumped because I haven't seen you guys in a little bit. And let's talk about Aretha real quick, because obviously you were tremendously influenced by a lot of that music from the 1960s. You did a nice tribute the other night.
Yeah, thank you very much. She was one of my favorites. And when I first started playing guitar, I'd only been playing like 2 years. I started at 10. And I remember some people telling me you should get up to see Aretha. And so I managed to get a ride up to San Francisco from the county I was living in, San Mateo, with my folks. And she was playing at Fillmore West when it was on Market Street in San Francisco. And, wow, I was, like, completely mesmerized and blown away. And I felt like I had the flu the whole night because my hairs and my arms were standing up. I felt like I had hair on my back, even though I didn't. And I felt like that was standing up. And I was, like, going, I never had experienced that, you know, feeling before listening to music. So she definitely touched my soul, you know. And I was a major fan after that for many, many years. Spent many hours listening to her sing and practicing with her and trying to, you know, figure out her tonality, like where the notes sat,
yeah,
what her blue notes were. She had a lot of blue notes, you know, like a lot of great blues players that she would hit that aren't exactly a half note or a whole note. They're in between somewhere. That's the way you slide into it. And her phrasing, you know, just... amazing. It was a tremendous loss to me when it came down last week, and I was like really upset for the whole day. I mean, really just got to me, and I said, I'm going to do something. So I just, you know, spur of the moment. I have a looper on stage that I use every night, and I kind of just feel out the audience when I get a solo spot, and whatever they're feeling like, I'll kind of lay down something that I can play over really quickly. And so I laid down some blues changes, and, you know, I thought about it before I went to the gig, and I called our lighting designer, and I said, hey, man, if you can get some pictures of Aretha to put up on the screen, you know, I'm going to do a tribute to her. I don't know exactly what I'm going to play, but it's going to be a tribute to her. So if you can put some pictures up, it would be really apropos. So. You know, Deuce got it together. We call him K2 Deuce. He's one of the best, I feel, in the world. But, you know, and it came off as real as it was, you know. And we did it, you know, the first night was in Fort Lauderdale. And the next night was going to be in Tampa. And Tampa, I did it again because it was like one night later, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there was a paper that kind of went at me and was kind of being snarky because I tried to correct him because it was a personal thing for me, right? That he, you know, it said Journey paid tribute to Aretha. And I go, no, Journey actually didn't. I did. You know, it was a personal thing for me. The whole band wasn't playing. Arnell wasn't singing. John wasn't playing keyboards. It was me playing by myself. And so let's just call it like it is. And give, you know, the realness of where it, of what it actually was. And so we went back and forth. And, you know, I got tired of it. And I woke up today and I was like, oh, man, I'm kind of freaking pissed.
So right, right.
I took it out like I've been doing lately. I'm finding that you got to call people out and you got to break it real, man. And when you're not lying, right, and you're telling the truth, people stand by you. They really do. And they appreciate the fact that you're sharing it with them. And then they start watching your back. And that's what I've been doing lately. You know, I mean, when things aren't feeling right, I write it. I put it out there. And, you know, I get tremendous feedback from it and great feeling from it that I'm doing the right thing. And rather than going, you know, around the block 25 times to try to get somewhere, you just put it out there, man. Somebody calls it wrong, and then you write a polite letter to them, and they still put it out in a snarky, jabbing way.
Yeah.
I'm going to freaking take a jab at it.
Right, right. Well, I can understand that. And by the way, I don't think anyone would be upset here in St. Louis on Friday night if you pull out that Aretha tribute then at Busch Stadium either.
Yeah, I didn't. You know, I don't want it to be a redundant thing because then it becomes like, you know, oh, ho-hum, you know, he's doing the same thing again. But I may just play something for her and have them not put her picture up.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, you can do it that way, sure.
Obvious, you know?
Absolutely. So how old, let's go back a little bit here before we get to what's going on right now with Journey. How old were you when you joined Santana? Were you really just 15 years old?
Yes, I was.
How does that happen? Come on.
You know, I did a lot of practicing, man, as a kid. I told you I started playing when I was 10.
Yeah.
And I really, you know, for 2 years, from 10 to 12, I was listening to a lot of blues, you know, the right guys like B.B. King and Albert King. And I loved Michael Bloomfield at that time, you know, who was previously in Paul Butterfield Blues Band from San Francisco. But then he was in Electric Flag, you know, and I really liked Electric Flag with Nick Gravanitis and Buddy Miles. That was like a slamming band, and I loved Michael's playing, and so I listened a lot to those guys, and I listened to a lot of jazz because my dad was a musician, and he always had like Miles playing around the house, or I was listening to Wes Montgomery, you know, cool jazz guitar players, and the blues were really, you know, that's what hit my core, and sort of, you know, I understood it. It got in my system. And then when I was playing it, I felt like I was talking it and walking it, not just saying, well, I can play a blues song. Watch this.
You know, yeah.
You got to get in it. You got to kind of feel it, the pain, you know, and where those notes are coming from. And, it, you know, it's a lot to do with who you listen to when you're learning. And, you know, I wish today that that music was more prevalent for a lot of younger artists to check out, because there's so much more there than, you know, playing, you know, everything on a sheet of music. I mean, it's great to have that theory and ability to do that, but even the greatest jazz artists I've ever talked to, whether it's Sean McLaughlin or stories that Carlos Santana tells me about Miles Davis, you know, they say, you know, learn as much as you can. But then before you go to play, you have to throw it away, man. Forget all the knowledge and come from all ears. Close your eyes and play.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Neal Schon is my guest on KMOX Profiles. My first exposure to music outside of the Partridge Family was... you know, I went to a blues bar in Chicago when I was a kid. They used to do these little matinees at a place called the Kingston Mines. And my friend who lives next door, his brother was a little older. We'd go and see the blues. And that was some of my first exposure. Well, it was my first exposure to live music ever.
That's awesome. You know, I mean, yeah, that's another issue that, you know, the younger generation doesn't have any longer. I lived in blues clubs when I was young. And fortunately enough, I had a guy that I met that was actually working for the Santana band before I even met those guys, that I met down in the peninsula, and he took me sort of under his wing and brought me up to San Francisco and introduced me to all the club owners. And, you know, in those days on the strip in San Francisco off of Broadway, it was all blues clubs and jazz clubs. And I'd walk up and down the street with a guitar. And after I got to know these guys, they'd let me in the back door because I was obviously underage. And they said, don't drink anything. You can't have water. You can't have anything.
Really?
Stay downstairs, and then you can go up on stage and play when they call you. Then you got to go back downstairs and go out the back door. So, but I'm grateful to those guys for letting me do that because that was the beginning of everything for me.
Well, how did the parents work into that when you're 15 years old? Did they know what was going on?
They did, man. It was like a funny story. Is like, you know, I was on that exact street I'm talking about on Broadway in San Francisco, and there was a club called the El Matador, and it was sort of on a nicer scale jazz club, a very intimate setting, maybe holds 50 people, 55 people, very, very small. But Kenny Burrell would play there, you know, all the great jazz artists. And I was hanging out with Carlos by then, and Carlos said, we're going to go see Gabor Szabo tonight. And I know many don't know who that is, but he is the guy. He was a gypsy guitar player. Had a very, very unique style, and they used one of his songs, Gypsy Queen, was put at the end of Peter Green, Fleetwood Mac's song, Black Magic Woman. And so they got Gypsy Queen from Gabor Szabo, and that's what the song kind of sounded like. And so Carlos says, we're going to go, and we're going to jam. And so I went there, and hanging out downstairs, like the club owner said. And then we went up on stage. Gabor came down. I met him. He says, we're going to call you up like in a couple songs. And Carlos and I went up. And lo and behold, I'm like up on stage and I start playing. I look out in the front row and there's my mother and father. And I was supposed to be down. I was supposed to be like down in the peninsula playing with some kids in a garage band.
That's a crazy story. That's awesome. And I'm guessing that they approved. So look, you go through a lot there with Santana. Let's briefly talk. I want to get to modern day and what's going on with these shows, but let's talk about Journey. And if you look at that stretch from 1975, you have the debut album, Look Into the Future, Next, Infinity. It was like every year, Evolution, Departure, Escape. Infinity sort of blew the doors off of everything, but obviously you guys were working hard before that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the first 3 years of Journey was just, you know, a bump and grind, man. You know, it was us traveling. Ainsley used to drive, Ainsley Dunbar, in the first three records. And, you know, all of us crammed in a station wagon. And we'd barely get to gigs in time to play a lot of times. And, you know, we definitely paid some hard dues and worked 12 months out of a year. And we were usually playing for 11 months. And then the 12th month, we'd cut a new record, whether or not we had material or not. And it was like that. And so that was our schedule for 3 years. And then nearing the end of the third year, we were all kind of beat up. We were attaining a great audience that we had discovered by playing with Lynyrd Skynyrd, of all bands. And, you know, we had opened up for everyone. We opened up for Kiss, you know, when they were first still in theaters. And I was like, I don't know what these guys are doing, man.
Right, right.
They got, like, makeup all day long. And I'm like, oh. And then they put on these shoes. And I'm like, what is this about, man? I don't get it. And, you know, we opened up for Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. We opened up for Cheech and Chong one night.
Oh, did you really? Even Cheech and Chong. Man, that's crazy. So then when do you realize that Journey is going to be a big deal? Was it Infinity?
Well, you know what? I felt like we were on the brink of something near the end of our third year because of that Lynyrd Skynyrd audience was the only audience out of all the people that we played with that actually got us, you know, as we were. And so we were playing big shows with them, and we were pulling down like three strong encores in front of them. And that was their audience, you know. So I was like, I was hopeful that things were going to happen. But at that point, we were still with CBS before they were Sony as a record label. And they came to our manager, Herbie Herbert, and he said, you know, you guys are going to need a new focal point. We think you need another lead singer, and we need to have some radio-friendly stuff. Otherwise, we're going to drop you. So, you know, that was the reality of everything. And so Herbie got a tape of a singer, Steve Perry.
I've heard of him. I think some people may have heard of him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can hear of him again, too, man. That's exciting about his record. I'm excited for him. And he sounds very good. I'm really happy to hear his voice.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Legendary guitar player and the founder of Journey, Neil Sean, my guest on KMOX Profiles. Before the break, you were talking a little bit about Steve Perry, and we mentioned his new song that's out. But how did you find Steve Perry?
He was in a band called Alien Project, and they were about to be signed on CBS. And his bass player apparently was killed in a car accident. And so they disbanded, and one of the guys from Columbia said, well, there's this amazing singer that's, you know, we were going to sign, and you guys need a singer. Why don't you check this out? Like, lo and behold, I didn't know, but I had met Steve like maybe 2 years before that and didn't know who he was, that he sang or anything, with a guy that I told you about, Jackie Villanueva, that would bring me up in the city and introduce me to all the club owners. I played one show, a one-off, with the Azteca band, which was like a spin-off of Santana in the 70s with like about 40 people in the band. It was a mess. And I played at the Kabuki Theater in San Francisco and played one show. And Jackie came up to me at the end of the gig, and I'm like humping my own gear and stuff. And I'm like going, he goes, hey, man, can you give my friend a ride to his car? And I said, sure, man. Where's his car? And he says, down a couple blocks. And so it was Steve, and he got in the car. I gave him a ride to the car, and I said, nice to meet you. You know, I didn't know that he sang or anything. And then,
and that was it then, for 2 years.
Yeah, and then he came. Then we played down at the Roxy, I believe, in L.A., a small little rock club down there. And he came backstage, and I recognized him, I think before we went on. And he was like, this was before, you know, the record company had said, we want this guy to be your singer. I'm going back in time. And he said, you know, I'm a singer. And I'm like, yeah, we got a singer. We're not really looking for a singer. You know? And so then the next year, lo and behold, it's Steve, you know? And I meet him, and we get together, and we had like immediate chemistry. And I have to really, you know, get credit where credit is due. I mean, Steve Perry showed me how to write for a vocalist, you know? And it wasn't like I didn't know how to do it. I just had never done it before that.
Well, what does that mean then? What does that, when you say that, what does that mean?
Well, you know, I mean, writing a song where the vocal is the main part of the song rather than the guitar.
I got you.
You know, there's a whole different thing, you know, I mean, you wrap yourself, you know, within that melody that he's singing on the bass notes, and you try to create the best, you know, voicings and the chords to, you know, make it sound as good as possible. And you have to think time-wise back then. It's really no longer like that, you know, because there's so little radio, right, and hit singles and all this and blah, blah, blah. And so in those days, you know, you had to have a single that was like no longer than 3 minutes and 30 seconds.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they were short songs.
Right. So, you know, you're basically looking at a stopwatch and you're going, okay, don't bore me, get to the chorus. And it was a completely different way of thinking, you know. for me, because I was into the jam band thing, and I could play for hours and hours and hours, and I still do, you know, and I love that. And so for me, it was harder to play less than to play more. And so I had to learn how to just restrain, but I learned how to play a lot more melody. You know, he was such an amazing vocalist that his melodies were so strong and melodic and soulful that I would always try to take off from where he left off, which wasn't an easy feat by any means, you know. But I felt like, well, if you're going to put a little guitar, like in Lights, for instance, that was like the second song we wrote together. And when he played me what he had, you know, somewhat of a chorus. And you know, it was more, it wasn't a stumble as it ended up being. And I put the intro on it, what he had, and then I wrote the bridge. And, you know, kind of everything fell together. But when I played the solo on that thing, it was like probably one of the best blues solos I've ever put on a Journey record by far.
Yeah, that's a great song, you know, period. But the background here, here in the background with Steve is amazing. So that begs the question. Neil Sean is my guest from Journey. They're here Friday night at Busch Stadium. I know you get sick and tired of these questions. You have nice things to say about Steve. He's there for the Hall of Fame induction. Is it his choice to not be in Journey? Or what is that, just that typical rock band tension? What can you say about that? And by the way, having said that, Arnell is amazing. And I want to talk about him, but he's amazing.
Arnell has been amazing. He's been a trooper. This is his 11th year, so by no means is he any new guy
right
on the block. He's been with us longer than any other singer has ever been with us. But luckily enough, we've all had, you know, all the songs, the amazing songs that we wrote together, and the legacy of being able to play those songs and keep on performing those songs with someone like Arnell. And, you know, it's like there's always been an open door for Steve. Everybody knows, I put it out there so many times that I can't believe people are still saying, is he going to come back to do a reunion? He has no aspiration to do a reunion. And, you know, and then, you know, all these, like, you know, rock sites, like melodic rock, not melodic rock, I don't know, classic rock magazine or the site, they'll take a jab and they'll say, well, Neil shuts down any reunion with Steve Perry. No, I didn't shoot down anything. It's just something that I understand where he's coming from. And when people ask me, I'll say he has no aspiration to do that. He's been there, done that. He wants to move forward, you know? And if I ever worked with him again, I'd want to move forward, too. I wouldn't want it to be Journey.
Well, how do you guys get so lucky? You know, I think a lot of people have seen the documentary with Arnell, because that is really, when you hear what he does with his vocals, you know, Steve Perry, obviously a legend for what he achieved with Journey, but Arnell fits right in. And how amazing is that he becomes a part of that band in the way that he did, right?
You know what? I went searching, and I'm sure everybody was searching. But I found him, and, you know, I just around the time I thought that, you know, there's no hope here, man. There's nobody that can do this. I found some very good male R&B singers that were in England, you know, in the UK, and they were soulful, and they had great voices, because there's a lot of, you know, soul in the UK. They love soul music. And with Steve Perry, you know, those were his roots, you know, the Sam Cooke thing, the R&B thing, and you rock it up with my guitar and bluesy guitar, and then that's kind of what made the Journey sound, was the mesh between the soul and the blues and the rock. And so if you just grab any tenor singer that can hit the notes, it doesn't mean it's going to fly, you know, because without the soul, it was like, I don't know.
Yeah, you got to feel it. It's chemistry. You got to feel it.
Right. And so anyway, I found Arnell, and I felt like he had the right voice, the tenor, high tenor voice. But then I heard how many styles he could sing, and he, you know, there was 40 clips on the internet that I had found. He was in a band called The Zoo, and they were doing copies in this little tiny club in Manila. And what I liked about what I saw is it was just, obviously, it was somebody's telephone. You know, the recording was real crappy, but you could tell that it was not doctored, you know? And we were getting lots, at this point, we were getting lots of packages of singers, you know, with their portfolio pictures and CD that was produced. And I'm like, man, I don't want to know about any of that because I don't even know if it's real. You know, with Pro Tools anymore, you can make anybody sound like they're good by retuning them and, you know, whatever. And so what I liked about YouTube is that everything was live there. And so when I saw him sing, and then I watched him for, you know, a few hours, sing all this different type of material from Zeppelin to Journey, Police, you name it. And he was covering it all. I go, man, this guy is a chameleon. He's not just a Journey cover band singer. He's a chameleon.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Neal Schon is my guest on KMOX Profiles. We were talking about Steve Perry, how you found him in the band, and then Arnell, who is this big YouTube star and can really sing anything. He joins the band. He's been in the band now longer than Steve Perry, and you call him a chameleon.
He's got, like, you know, 20 different voices that he does, and ultimately, they're all him. Because he does it with such conviction. And I don't know if you've heard, we have a single out there right now, and I believe that they don't even have a record label, but it was in the top a week ago. It was number 27 on the rock charts, and it's for a benefit, Rock Against Trafficking. It's a full album that's coming out with a lot of great artists, and right now, currently, we're on the charts with Glenn Hughes. And Glenn Hughes, I believe, did Roxanne. And he's number 7 right now. And the whole album is redos of Police songs. And so I chose to do, I got involved in a project because I felt like it was a good cause and also an opportunity just to have some fun and do something different, you know? And so I chose Synchronicity, too. And I went in the studio and I cut the whole song by myself with, like, just a drum machine and played the bass. And then Arnell, you know, came into town, and we were getting ready for a tour a couple years ago. And so I booked out the little studio next to the bigger studio we were in, rehearsing. And he came in, and he sang it one take, and it was, like, unbelievable. Then at that point, I heard it, and I went, wow, this is, like, amazing. I feel like I want to do something different to it. And so I stretched out and I changed the solo section in the middle, which is sort of like just an excursion section in the original Police track. So I made it a little more tripped out, a little more form for my guitar playing. And then I listened to it again and I go, wow, man, I'd like to make, what if I play this thing sometime? What if when this record comes out and they have a big festival, said, what would I want to add on this? And so I decided I wanted to orchestrate it more and make it sound like Live and Let Die, you know, and put like some, like, Tommy vibe into
well,
it.
Let
like
me see. I did. Is this it here, Neil? Because I was trying to do some searching here. Is this it? Listen. Is that the, I found that on YouTube right there.
Yeah.
I got to listen to that because I haven't heard about that. So that came out, what, in May?
Yeah, and it's climbing up the charts, and they feel like, and we don't even have a label, but everybody's, like, you know, digging it, and they're working it on the inside, and they say they think they're going to get in the top 10, but I'm using it right now, you know, because it's Arnell, myself, and Steve Smith on drums.
And you listen to Arnell right there. I mean, he sounds like Sting.
Amazing.
He is a chameleon. That is. Sorry, I'm going to check that out. I'm glad that you tipped us off on that for those people who hadn't heard about it. So how important, Neal Schon, was the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction to you?
You know what was really important to me? I mean, it's an honor to be in, but, you know, I felt like we were already in because of the fans' acceptance all these years. That, to me, is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, is when fans accept you year after year, you know. But the important thing for me was that we were, you know, I felt that Greg should be there, Raleigh should be there, and it was really nice to have Ainsley, too, because they were a big part of the foundation that we built to get where we got. And so I held out on some things to make sure that happened. And some people were not very happy with me, but I did it anyway because I felt like it was the right thing to do. And at the end of the night, it was very emotional for me. You know, I mean, it was great seeing Perry. I had not seen him since we did Hollywood Walk of Fame a decade and a few years before that. And it was emotional for both of us, but we reconnected, you know, backstage before we went on stage and were inducted. And I could tell that we were still connected, you know, like brothers. And I felt that there's something that will happen again. Give it some time, you know. He's just putting out his record, and hopefully he'll go out and play some dates. And I have a whole year free next year to do whatever I want. And so I plan on going out and doing some touring myself. I have a solo record coming out called Universe that's all instrumental with orchestra. And then I'm doing some dates with Journey Through Time, which is a one-off thing that I did in San Francisco, which was for fire relief. When all the fires in California were happening, I did a benefit there, and, you know, I took the opportunity to get together with some old friends. And I had Greg Raleigh, and I had Dean Castronova, and I had Marco Mendoza on bass, and I had John Varn on keyboards. And we covered everything from Journey's first record to Frontiers.
Wow. I mean, that would be fun to hear for sure. Hey, by the way, since you're along with you guys, you got Def Leppard and Cheap Trick. Does Cheap Trick and Journey haze Def Leppard because they are not yet in the Hall of Fame?
I can tell you one thing right now, that Def Leppard will be in the Hall of Fame next year.
I think you're right.
Watching how this works.
Yeah.
And it's all politics.
Yeah, no, I know that. They're definitely going to get in. There's no, with all those hits and everything that they did. And look, this show on Friday night, hit after hit after hit. I'm excited. I'm a big Cheap Trick fan. I had, you know, Joe Elliott on a few months ago talking about, or Steve Clark talking about Def Leppard. I'm glad to have you on here. How much, I'll ask this one question here, because I'm pretty sure, I don't know the whole set list, but I'm pretty sure Don't Stop Believing is going to be played on Friday night. How much did The Sopranos change the influence of that song?
I think it brought back an awareness of the song that I thought would have already been there. I mean, honestly, when we recorded the whole record that was released on, when we got done with that song, rehearsing in my warehouse, and we went in and cut it, I remember sitting in, you know, Fantasy in a playback room, and I'm listening to the song after Steve had sung it, and I looked at him and John, and I go, I think this song is going to be massive, okay? And so it's funny that I was right. It just happened many, many years later. It was always a big song, but there were many big songs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, Lights, when we play Lights every night, that is like the new anthem. The whole place lights up. The whole place sings it. I mean, depending on where you, I can hear all everybody's cell phone, right?
Yeah, oh, right,
and
right.
Depending where you're standing, you can barely hear the band. The audience is singing it so loud. And so that is like although it's always been an anthem, it's like a new anthem for us again.
Don't stop believing. Hold on to that feeling. Steel light.
You've been listening to Profiles. If you missed any of this episode or to hear other profiles, go to KMOX.com and click on demand.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.